Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. Hello, and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week, I'm talking with Michael Tisserand, author of Crazy, George Harriman, A Life in Black and White. And I'll have a few gift book suggestions for the book lovers on your list. Michael Tisserand has written about many aspects of New Orleans life and culture in his long career as a journalist and as the former editor of Gambit Weekly. His first book, The Kingdom of Zydeco, is one of my favorites and has just been published in paperback with a new introduction by Buckwheat Zydeco. His second book is a classic of post-Katrina literature, Sugarcane Academy. And today we'll be talking about his third book, the long-awaited Crazy, George Harriman, A Life in Black and White. So Michael Tisserand, welcome to The Reading Life.
Good to be back here, Susan. Good to see you.
Now, how did you discover George Harriman in the first place? This is the first full-length biography of him, and it's almost as if his life were a story waiting for you to come along.
Well, as a child, I loved old comics, and I would beg my mom to take me to this library in southern Indiana called the Willard Library, which is said to be haunted. It's this old creaky library on the hill, and I discovered on my own 741.59, which is where all the books about comics are, and it was on the bottom shelf, and I would sit in the corner of the library and read all these, and discovered, you know, Cassandjammer Kids and Bringing Up Father and all these. It's just so bizarre. And Dick Tracy was weirder and more violent than anything that was on TV. So I was a fan of old comics, but had never written about them. And when I was at Gambit, I tried to bring as many comics to the paper as I could, actually. And the DuBose family, Clancy and Margo, were very patient with me about that. And I was going to do a cover story on George Harriman because he was a native son of New Orleans that people didn't fully understand, both people in New Orleans and outside, didn't understand his connection to the city.
Right.
So I just started to do some research about that, and I let that go after Katrina, and I moved to Chicago for a couple of years. And then an exhibit came by. I was going across the country and stopped in Milwaukee called the Masters of American Comics. And the second room was all George Harriman original comics. The beautiful ink work, and you can see the faint pencil work underneath it. And a lot of them were actually Gary Trudeau's. He owned a lot of those originals and loaned them to the exhibit. So my son was with me. He's 6'4 now, but at the time I was carrying him around and reading the comics out loud to him. And it was, I think, a combination of seeing the art on the wall and reading for the first time Harriman's words out loud that made me realize I wanted to write more about him. I think also as I was feeling like a New Orleans exile at that point, and I identified a bit with what I tried to guess at he must have felt as a 10-year-old, you know, in Los Angeles, having left everything he knew behind in New Orleans.
And he was part of that great migration
really at
to
very
California.
Really, the very beginning of it, yeah. And then just as far as writing a book, at that point, even though I'd been living outside of New Orleans, I'd only been working on stuff about New Orleans. And I was kind of looking for a project that could be about New Orleans culture, but that I could also do when I was living in Chicago, which I thought I was going to be doing at that time. And fortunately, I was able to move back here and work on it here.
Hallelujah.
Well, it was.
Glad you're back.
Yeah, and finding the New Orleans stories were really difficult. And I had to spend a lot of time in the notarial archives in City Hall and at the Archdiocese archives. And that's where the secrets were really kept, in the Archdiocese records. That's where parents and grandparents were named in the baptismal records and the wedding records. So I was really happy that I was able to be here in New Orleans and spend extra time on that work.
Well, and that's one of the things that's so fascinating about this whole story is that so much of it is about racial ambiguity and sexual ambiguity. You make comparisons to Anatole Brouillard, for example.
Yeah, Crazy Cat is a character that is neither male nor female, or both male and female, which was very frustrating to William Hearst's newspaper readers. They would complain about that constantly. And Crazy Cat changes color constantly as well. some of them are kind of set up like slapstick comedies where a crazy cat will walk under a door and a bag of flour will drop on Crazy Cat and turn Crazy Cat white. But then there'll be these wonderful little things that Crazy Cat says about, you know, looking in the mirror and saying, I have an inferiority complexion. And, you know, I don't want to tie Harriman's work down to his personal history because there's so much wonder and delight and so many fantastic qualities to it that I always see something new every time I read it. But at the same time, the more I learned about Harriman's life, the more things started to light up for me when I was reading Crazy Cat. You know, Harriman was, he was born to a free people of color family. They were incredibly politically active. They signed onto the petition that was hand-delivered to Abraham Lincoln for voting rights. They passed out tickets to political rallies at their tailor shop on the 300 block of Royal Street. But when Harriman and his family moved to Los Angeles, I think for education, I think to get the children, the family, especially the boys in that case, an education. But they moved to Los Angeles. What they were, what Harriman believed himself to be, really just didn't exist anymore. It really didn't exist legally and culturally, not quite so much in New Orleans and also really across the country. So that's one reason I call it a life in black and white, is that, you know, he's kind of beyond black and white, and he had to live a life in black and white, both in the newspaper and in our sort of binary racial system that we just started to now catch up with Harriman.
And I thought it was so interesting that you said that you don't think his wife knew.
Yeah, I have no reason to believe that she did. Harriman's granddaughter, who is a big friend and fan of this book, and I've been very fortunate to get to know, just sort of said in general that hers was a secretive family. There was kind of a don't ask, don't tell policy with his race. I think that's why he was nicknamed George the Greek. And certainly if it was advertised and publicly known that he came from a mixed race background in New Orleans, his position at the Hearst newspapers would not have been open to him. It's impossible to overstate how beloved he was and how deeply respected he was among his peers. So, of course, nothing like some murky family background for these brilliant artists and writers and thinkers who were working in comics for the Hearst papers at that time, nothing like that was going to stand in their way. So they help him with the cover story and make some jokes about it and call him George the Greek and say, as his friend Tad Dorgan, the cartoonist, said, none of us knew what he was, so we called him George the Greek.
Oh, and I love his notion of being a sprite in the world, you know?
Yeah, a few things happened with the development of the character Crazy Cat, which is, I think, one of the great American fictional characters ever created. And it started off really as kind of reflection of vaudeville and minstrel show humor. And some of the language that actually comes from the kind of malapropisms and other things that fuel that those kind of stage shows. I think when he discovered Charlie Chaplin in 1916, when he probably saw the first films and maybe saw him on stage. But I think he saw a character, and Harriman wrote about seeing the character in Gold Rush. It just kind of emerges there as this sprite. He called Chaplin a sprite, and he called Crazy a sprite also. And I think, you know, Harriman was very schooled in Shakespeare. And I think there's Ariel as sort of an inspiration for Crazy in that sense, too.
And I love that you refer to him so often as elegant, because there is so much elegance in Chaplin, in Crazy.
Yeah.
You know, elegance of line, elegance of thought. All kinds of things there. One of the things I love about this story, and I'm sure this was so much fun for you to write, is that this is also a huge story about the history of American newspapers.
It is.
And comics. And so many great journalists are part of this story as you go along.
Right.
That must have been a blast.
To come across and see, oh, look, there's Damon Runyon.
Yes.
<You know? laughs> Oh, yeah, absolutely. And as you do, I know, I treasure the role of newspapers in society. And some of that is having a newspaper where you can go through the pages and stumble across something like Crazy Cat that you weren't necessarily looking for. Now so much media is something we're looking for. And here's something that Hearst readers who did not want to read Crazy Cat, they complained about, I mean, not all, of course, but the majority. You know, every time there was a comics poll, and had them back then, every time, you know, they said, name your favorite comic, name your least favorite comic. Crazy Cat was always in the bottom. And there's a story that Hearst personally intervened to keep Crazy Cat in the paper, which I couldn't quite verify. But it does seem as if Harriman was kept in the paper for reasons other than his popularity. And I think that's a treasure, that newspaper. And that Hearst, not always the most cherished journalist.
Not at all.
But absolutely that's something he should be credited for.
And Harriman was part of the first dedicated comics page.
Yeah.
It'll newspaper history, which I found so fascinating in 1912.
Yeah, Harriman, you know, he came up as an office boy working at the Los Angeles Herald when he was only 16. He was doing comics, really pretty stunning comics by the time he was 21, 22. And then when he got into William Hearst newspapers, there was this cadre of really fantastic characters, Harry Hirschfeld and Tad Dorgan and Gus Mauger. And those pages are fascinating. You know what else is really fascinating to read about those comics pages that I didn't realize until I spent a good year looking at microfilm is they all reflected the news of the day in really interesting ways. There'd be a story about something on the front page and they would seep into the comics page the next day. And it was kind of this dialogue back and forth between the front page and the comics page.
Well, and the immediacy of the comics at that time is sports, you know? Mm-hmm. There's so much about sports in this book, which I find wildly entertaining.
And I wasn't expecting at all.
Really?
No. When I found that Harriman was a sports cartoonist for years leading up to the development of Crazy Cat, I did not know that tradition. Mm-hmm. And sports pages look great when there's a big cartoon on the top of them, I must say. So New Orleans newspapers?
Listen up.
Listen up. And, you know, Tad Dorgan, Harriman's friend, was sort of the great figure in this. And he would use sports cartoons to explicate the sport, to actually show, you know, this is the way this boxer leveled this boxer, you know, with this particular, you know, he would use it as a way of diagramming with great humor, but would kind of diagram the sport itself. And Harriman, maybe once or twice, but hardly ever used cartoons in this way. He would create these huge classic, you know, using Greek myth and, you know, Shakespearean tragedies. He'd create these huge pageants out of the sports match and then would fill the little corners with humorous things that he saw, people in the grandstands, what they were joking about and laughing and yelling about.
Well, you're right. They would make a nice addition to sports pages now. And he was present in so many key moments. I mean, he was one of those Forrest Gump-like guys.
Yeah.
He was in the right place at the right time.
Yeah, I kept thinking Zelig as I was reading. Mm-hmm. The fact, you know, the very beginning of the newspaper war between Joseph Pulitzer and William Randolph Hearst, which was largely waged with comics, with the Yellow Kid,
yes,
and other comics, with Hearst coming into town and waving his big bills around and swiping Pulitzer's team away from him. But Harriman was right in the middle of that also, making cartoons and working in the middle of that. He was living on Coney Island.
I know, I love that.
Right, at the age of vaudeville and mass entertainment, really just beginning.
Mm-hmm.
He was there at the Hal Roach Studios when Laurel and Hardy and Our Gang were making movies, and he would think of a joke and they would use it in a movie, and they would discard a joke and he would use it in his strip.
I love that there are these little touches of his all through the culture. You know what I mean? One of the things that's so fascinating to me about this is that, you know, you talk so much about his literary inspirations, Dickens, mm-hmm. Shakespeare, yeah, and you really make a wonderful case for that. And I wonder if you'd read that little passage you brought along of Harriman's writing.
Sure. This is a character named Bumblebee. It's my favorite character besides Crazy and Ignatz. It's this little hobo bee that kind of wanders in, and he always gets the greatest introduction. Jack Kerouac was a fan of Crazy Cat and said Crazy Cat was an inspiration for the Beats and for the Beat movement. And I have to think that Bumblebee was on Jack Kerouac's mind when he said that. Here's one short introduction. Bumblebee is walking into a saloon, and there's a little voice bubble coming up from behind the saloon door saying, "Fill him up again, Juan." And Bumblebee's kind of scowling, carrying the bindle on his back. "Now let us turn to that peripatetic pilgrim, Bumblebee. He whom fate cannot control, nor destiny decree, render of homage to the gods of nihility, governed by law of neither man nor moon, sun nor star, a drone dallying in the dale of dalliance without maid, mate, or mistress."
You read that very well.
Mm-hmm. By the way, I recommend reading Crazy Cat aloud.
Aloud, yes.
Crazy Cat can be difficult. I mean, Crazy Cat is not an easy, there's a reason why readers didn't always care for the strip. It can be a difficult read. And in the biography, I tried not to have a lot of my theories in there because mm-hmm. I always changed my mind about Crazy Cat. I wanted to sort of give a portrayal of Harriman's life that people can build off of as they continue to read and study Crazy Cat. But my feeling is that I think Harriman had troubles in some way creating a character that was neither black nor white, working with ink on paper, and was always kind of flipping back and forth. In one strip, Crazy Cat and Ignatz are sitting, I think, in front of a log, and an art critic comes along, or an artist, you know, and says, "Oh, a study in black and white." And then Crazy Cat and Ignatz say, "Let's switch colors, let's fool him." And then Crazy Cat turns white, and Ignatz turns black, and then the artist comes along and says, "Oh, another study in black and white."
Right.
But then in Crazy Cat's language, that's where I think Harriman created something that absolutely communicated the American character in a completely new way. You know, we in New Orleans, I think, can maybe understand that a little more deeply than some others because of our language being this great mixture of cultures. You mentioned Buckwheat Zydeco, my Zydeco book. This is not New Orleans, of course. This is South Louisiana. You know, but his first record was Moche de Chaoui, which has Creole, American Indian, and French, you know, in one sentence. So I think there's like an innate sense of that in Louisiana, that the American culture is this beautiful mixture and beautiful crossroads and meeting point and become something new. And in Crazy Cat's dialogue and in Crazy Cat's language and what Crazy Cat says, there is Elizabethan English and there's German, there's French, there's Creole, there's Yiddish, there's stuff I don't recognize. And Harriman himself spoke many languages. And I highly recommend just reading Crazy Cat aloud. And
it
I think that's
a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. One of the many things I love about this book, obviously, it's such a story of an art form. I mean, you are so wonderful in talking about the things that distinguish his work, his flourishes, the way he anthropomorphized animals, the self-referential characters, and the big literary context he drew from, and also those panoramic landscapes. The idea of minstrelsy is something he followed through in all of his work. And that must have been a lot of fun for you to have that kind of visual focus in a way, to be thinking about an art form and how it evolved over time.
Yeah, when you read the cartoonists who talk about Harriman, they usually talk about the visuals more than anything else. I found an interview with Elsie Segar, who drew Popeye, and he said, you know, the way that Harriman draws a man going around the corner, that's worth more than anything else. The way that figure, the way that leg stretches out. Patrick McDonnell, who draws the comic strip Mutts, which is visually very influenced by George Harriman, has said basically you could take one of those Sunday pages and black out all the panels, and just graphically, it's beautiful. And I agree with him. Every single page, except for one period of time when Harriman was constrained and had to do things a certain kind of way for commercial reasons, but they happily abandoned that just for a few years. But in all the other times, in all the other years, every single page was a brand new canvas for Harriman. And he took the opportunity to create the comic that he wanted to.
Well, and I love the way you talk about how cartoonists are all scholars of their art form, that they all know the other cartoonists and know their work so well and are touched by it.
Yeah, that was my first job, is to inculcate myself within the cartooning community. And I was very nervous when I first started out because I hadn't really proven myself in writing about comics. And here I am writing about the top guy. You know, many, many cartoonists, not all, but many consider Harriman to be one of the top one, two, or three cartoonists, and sort of the master of the form and a godfather of their own work. It's been extraordinary. Mm-hmm. I've had all these folks, whether it's, you know, Art Spiegelman, who created Mouse, you know, the first graphic novel to receive a Pulitzer Prize, and it's still, I think, my favorite book, to Brian Walker, who is the son of Mort Walker. He writes High and Lois and Beetle Bailey, which you don't think about in the same terms as Crazy Cat, as far as the kind of style of humor they have. But Brian is a big scholar and actually co-curated the first exhibit of that original Harriman art I saw. And all these people opened up their literal boxes, their cardboard boxes of research for me. And I spent one of my favorite afternoons was in Mort Walker's studio with Beetle Bailey all around me at his private Xerox machine, copying, you know, old editor and publisher magazines and things like that.
Oh, that's great.
But generosity abounded across the comics world, and it was a delight.
Well, you would hope and think it's a generous world there. So what did this book do for you? You spent so much time with George Harriman now. I mean, this is a long process for you. What is it that brings you two together? What are you taking away from this that serves you in your own life?
Harriman, in his letters, in a couple of letters I found, could get depressed. He had a lot of health concerns in the end of his life. He loved his daughter, Bobby Harriman, adored her, and it comes through repeatedly. She was sick for most of her life and died very young. His wife died in a tragic car accident. He went through World War I. He went through the racially charged boxing match I talk about in 1910. And his sense of wonder and delight never dimmed up until the very last strip he drew. And even though in his letters sometimes he would say things like, you know, I'm not sure anyone reads this junk. They could be switching in old strips and nobody would notice. And you know, he could be very self-effacing. And yet his work is confident and never loses confidence and never is anything less than a bold statement of vision and beauty and wonder and delight. And He never shies away from bringing in Dickens or Shakespeare or the graphics from a Navajo rug, or whatever he wants to bring in, he brings it all in. And that commitment to work is absolutely something that I've turned to many times when I needed to recommit myself to this book. Yeah, absolutely.
Well, there's a lot of wonder and delight for readers here, so you're carrying on a great tradition. We've been talking with Michael Tisserand, whose fascinating new book is the biography of a New Orleans original, Crazy, George Harriman, A Life in Black and White. You can meet Michael Tuesday, December 6th at 6 at Octavia Books. Michael, thank you so much.
Thank you, Susan. Great to be here.
Love books about books in the book world, love to give them, love to receive them. Here are some of the year's best for holiday giving. The Book, a cover-to-cover exploration of the most powerful object of our time by Keith Houston, is a beautifully designed guide to its subject with headbands, end papers, all the parts of a book neatly marked. This history takes us from the very beginning of paper, all the way through illuminated manuscripts to modern printing. It's fascinating, written with style and attitude and humor. It's never too late to be reminded of what a treasure you're holding in your hands, whether it's made of papyrus or paper or pixels. There are many great destination bookstores in the world, and one of the most famous is on the Paris Left Bank. Shakespeare and Company, A History of the Rag and Bone Shop of the Heart, edited by Krista Halverson, is a beautiful tribute to that shop with its long history. The contemporary location on the Rue Boucherie has long replaced Sylvia Beach's original shop near the Luxembourg Gardens, but the late George Whitman and now his daughter Sylvia Beach Whitman have followed in those footsteps, welcoming writers and readers. Beautiful photos with wonderful writing by famous visitors, supplementing the store's official history. This is a dreamy way to while away an afternoon. Literary Wonderlands, A Journey Through the Greatest Fictional Worlds Ever Created, edited by Laura Miller, is a fine travel guide to fictional universes of and beyond this world. Whether it's L. Frank Baum's Oz, or C.S. Lewis's Narnia, or Lewis Carroll's Wonderland, or the kingdoms of George R.R. Martin's Game of Thrones that you enjoy, you'll be transported to the landscapes of books you love in this gorgeously illustrated and informative volume. Boundless Books, 50 Literary Classics Transformed into Works of Art by Poster Text, is a collection of those clever posters that include all the words of a book made into a memorable image. The cover illustration is that beloved profile of Sherlock Holmes with deerstalker and pipe. A magnifying glass attached with a ribbon lets you read the text. You may not have wall space for all 50 posters, but you can enjoy them all in one book. The publishing house of Alfred A. Knopf has produced some of the world's best books in its long and distinguished history, and two new biographies give us a recent behind-the-scenes look. The Lady with the Borzoi, Blanche Knopf, Literary Tastemaker Extraordinaire by Laura Claridge, takes us back to the glamorous early days of American publishing. Blanche Knopf socialized with the best and brightest of her era, brought European writers such as Camus and de Beauvoir to American audiences, and published hard-boiled fiction before hard-boiled fiction was cool. She traveled the world, even during wartime, in search of good books and brought them home. Thomas Mann called her the soul of the firm, and we are still reading books she acquired, now classics. Avid Reader, A Life by Robert Gottlieb is a memoir by an editor who started out at Simon & Schuster and rose to executive editor there, then left to run Alfred A. Knopf as executive editor. He would also serve as editor of The New Yorker, succeeding the great William Shawn. What a tastemaker he is. He brought us the work of Toni Morrison, Doris Lessing, and Miss Piggy, to name only a few of my favorites. And in an interesting chapter, he describes working with John Kennedy Toole on the early version of Confederacy of Dunces, which he calls his most conspicuous failure. In this name-dropping diary of a life well-lived, Gottlieb makes publishing sound like so much fun, you'd be tempted to head to New York yourself. but I'm not sure publishers are having quite as much fun today. But if you love books, you'll be captivated by Gottlieb's voice of experience. Here's the very first sentence. I began as I would go on, reading. What could possibly be better? Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Lori Nichols signs Maple and Willow's Christmas Tree, Tuesday, December 6th at 3:30 at Octavia Books. Scott Solomon signs Future Humans, Inside the Science of Our Continuing Evolution, Tuesday, December 6th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Today's guest, Michael Tisserand, signs Crazy, George Harriman, A Life in Black and White, Tuesday, December 6th at 6 at Octavia Books. Tyler Bridges and Jeremy Alford sign Longshot, A Soldier, A Senator, A Serious Sin, An Epic Louisiana Election, Wednesday, December 7th at 6 at Octavia Books. David Netto discusses his work with Sarah Costello and signs his book about the interior designer Francois Catroux, Wednesday, December 7th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. David Lee Campbell signs The Double Life, A Survivor's Guide to Transcend Success and Tragedy, Thursday, December 8th at 6 at Octavia Books. Stephanie Jane Carter, editor of Edible New Orleans, moderates a discussion with Pablo Johnson, James Nolan, Brett Martin, and El Casimu Harris, who all appear in the Best Food Writing 2016, Thursday, December 8th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Sarah Slaughter is the guest facilitator of a discussion of So Long, See You Tomorrow by William Maxwell. That's at the Maple Street Bookshop Book Club, Thursday, December 8th at 6 at Maple Street Bookshop. Louisiana Cultural Vistas debuts its winter issue Thursday, December 8th from 6 to 8 at Buffalo Gas and Electric Lighting, 318 Royal Street. The event features the debut of An Ignatian Journey, a new mobile map based on John Kennedy Toole's classic New Orleans novel, A Confederacy of Dunces. That'll be followed by a brief tour of French Quarter locations depicted in the book. Peggy Scott Labour discusses and signs The Fairgrounds Through the Lens, Thursday, December 8th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. The Octavia Books Science Fiction Book Club discusses Sarah Canary by Karen Joy Fowler, Saturday, December 10th at 10:30 at Octavia Books. John Kemp signs Expressions of Place, The Contemporary Louisiana Landscape, Saturday, December 10th from 11 to 1 at Bay Books in Bay St. Louis, and later that day from 5 to 7 at Lemieux Gallery on Julia Street. Morgan Moulthrop, author of Jean Lafitte's Pirate Code, will speak at M.S. Rao Antiques Saturday, December 10th at 11 a.m. The Dickens Fellowship of New Orleans holds its annual Christmas Carol Read-Along, Saturday, December 10th from 2 to 4 at the Bright Library at Metairie Park Country Day School. There will be a group reading by University of New Orleans professor John Gary's creative writing students, Sunday, December 11th at 3 at the Maple Leaf Bar. And there will be a presentation by family and friends of The Shy Mirror, a collection of poems by the late Gordon Robert Sabatier, Tuesday, December 13th at 6 at Octavia Books. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.